This week in KMA land, Shenandoah candidates square off in KMA Forum. Candidates weigh in on water issues. State officials rule on Shenandoah police issue. Shenandoah School Board hears conference update. And federal government shutdown impacts Shen sewer plant payments. I'm Mike Peterson. It was Meet the Candidates live on stage in Shenandoah this week. Candidates for Shenandoah's mayoral and city council positions faced off in person in a public forum Monday night, airing live on KMA and live streamed at KMALand.com from the Gladys Wersig Jones Auditorium. Candidates fielded questions on a number of topics, including the issue of transparency in city government. While saying he believes the city is getting the information out to the public, Shenandoah Mayor Roger McQueen says there's opportunities for improvement in terms of transparency.
We're in a changing world with the internet and everything else, and so we have tried, you know, in the last year or so to get some of these things maybe up to date a little more, where people, because we did find out that more people use the internet to find information. So, you know, we're trailing in that, and I'll be the first to say we are.
Improved transparency is a central point of Jerry Wagaman's mayoral campaign.
You know, we look at a lot of ordinances that the city has involved. Everybody seems to be talking about the fact the only way they can find out about an ordinance is to actually go to the city hall, ask somebody about it. To me, I believe that something like that is something that should be posted online. All city ordinances, in my opinion, should always be posted online so they're accessible 24/7 to everybody to go see and see what's going on.
Incumbent First Ward Councilman Rita Gibson says the city is working with a company to put city ordinances and other information on the city's website. Gibson's challenger, Jeffrey Capp, says there's got to be a better way of getting information out to the public.
You know, people up here say, oh, you know, call Tim or call Tom or whoever, and they're going to talk to you or come to the meeting. A lot of people are extremely intimidated by that. And other people, they own businesses and they don't want to speak their mind because they're afraid of, you know, something bad coming their way.
Jeff Heiser is a former Shenandoah school superintendent, one of four at-large council candidates. Heiser believes the city needs to update online materials faster.
When I was superintendent, as soon as a policy changed, it went online. We could also have an updated ordinance book available where you didn't have to ask the clerk, but on one of the counters outside there, one in the library. I know I went over there to look at something, and it was a waste of time because it wasn't updated.
At-large council candidate Kathy Silvestri adds transparency has been a long-running issue in the community.
I have personally asked every other month two council members for the past 4.5 years regarding ordinances and being put online. And every answer that I got, and I can go through them, says we are working on it, and they are yet to be online.
Another at-large candidate, Matthew Regan, believes council meetings should be live-streamed. A fourth at-large candidate, Alan Jordan, says while young people gravitate towards social media, he would like to see the city publish a newsletter. Incumbent 3rd Ward Councilman Kim Swank, who is unchallenged for re-election, says the council should hold down town hall meetings, allowing for residents' voices to be heard. Candidates also discussed one of Shenandoah's hottest and wettest issues, the continuing water situation. 1 year ago this month, the Shenandoah City Council approved a resolution placing the community under Stage 4 water conservation. During Monday night's forum, again co-sponsored by KMA and the Forum to Revitalize Shenandoah, candidates were asked whether they had a plan to ease the community out of Stage 4 regulations. While saying he didn't have a specific plan, mayoral candidate Jerry Wagaman says it all depends on the weather.
We cannot control what the weather is going to do. We can't control if it's going to rain, not going to rain. All we can do is see what's going to take place with the water, when it's brought in, when the wells are all installed, and how long this is going to take before everything's back up to quote normal.
Wagman's opponent, incumbent Mayor Roger McQueen, says the city has been proactive about the water situation for the past year and a half with new water wells and the proposed Fremont Berry Channel Aquifer Project.
We did put two new wells in. They are online. That's given us a little more water coming in. But you know what? If we don't get the rain, we don't fill the wells up. So the next option was, and this is what we're in the process of doing right now, is running a 6.5 mile pipe from the Fremont Channel Aquifer west of town into our water plant.
While saying the new wells will help, incumbent First Ward Councilwoman Rita Gibson says filling the wells will take time.
It takes a while for the water to replenish when you don't have the rain to put the moisture back in the wells. And it is going to take, there's hoops you have to go through when you're dealing with the DNR and the government on getting the aquifer through. And hopefully when we do that, that will relinquish the stage four.
Gibson's opponent, challenger Jeffrey Capps, lauded City Water Superintendent Tim Martin for explaining the city's water situation at a recent council meeting. But at-large council candidate Jeff Heiser chastised the current city government for not preparing years ahead of time for water issues. Another at-large council candidate, Alan Jordan, aired similar criticism.
I think if we're talking about foresight and what needs to happen, I think we need to kind of look ahead at what could possibly happen. And in an emergency situation like we have now, maybe we need to do something ahead of getting attached to this other aquifer. That's going to take several years to get water here. What happens if we run out? I mean, the citizens of Shenandoah are going to be a little upset.
With the new wells installed, at-large candidate Matthew Regan believes the city is on the uphill climb in terms of water issues.
It'll be very beneficial getting everything filled back up. Maybe looking towards some other options in water just in case if the wells don't work out or anything. But I feel like we've been patient enough, and it's been very inconvenient for a lot of situations. But we still have water.
At-large council candidate Kathy Silvestri called for every resident and business to continue conserving water for the time being. This week's Shenandoah Candidates Forum is available online at KMALand.com as well as on the KMA YouTube page. As the election campaign continues, a ruling that Shenandoah police representatives violated prohibited practice regulations in the department's union agreement went public this week. Ethan Hewitt had the story.
At an early September meeting, the Iowa Employment Appeal Board determined that a designated representative of the city of Shenandoah, identified in the board's documents as Police Chief Josh Gray, committed a prohibited practice in August of 2024 under Iowa Code Chapter 20.102A against that employee, Jeff Hoyt. The complaint was filed to the state board in November of 2024 by the Teamsters Local Union No. 238. According to the order, the violation occurred when Gray told Hoyt during a meeting with City Administrator A.J. Lyman and Union Representative Bryston Dunkison that Hoyt should not have contacted the union regarding terms and condition of his employment and that he had breached the chain of command by involving the union and the city administrator. The state order also indicates that Assistant Chief Ethan Johnson, quote, reiterated that there is a chain of command in the police department, end quote, and that Hoyt should have not gone to the union. State officials say that under these circumstances, it would be reasonable for an employee to feel pressured to not seek assistance from the union and fear possible retaliation for doing so. Well, per the order, Hoyt had started as a reserve officer in the police department in 2017 before beginning full-time employment with the city in the Parks and Recreation Department in August 2020 and shifting to the Streets Department in 2021 and then working as a full-time water operator. The order states discussions took place in May and June of 2024 about Hoyt becoming a full-time police officer with wages approved by the city council that summer, listing him at full-time pay upon a fall hiring. Well, state officials indicate the August 2024 meeting was prompted by disputes over when certain pay levels would begin related to certification with the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. Well, the order states that Hoyt was then suspended from the police department in November 2024 for, quote, not completing the ILEA requirements, end quote. To remedy the violation, the city was ordered to cease and desist from further violations of Chapter 20 and to post a notice in a prominent place in its main offices accessible to the general public and customary areas for information to employees in the affected bargaining units for no less than 30 days. Shenandoah Mayor Roger McQueen tells KMA News the city is not providing comment on the matter at this time. A copy of the complete order from the Iowa Employment Appeal Board is available with this story at KMALand.com. Ethan Hewitt reporting.
Shenandoah School District may join a new athletic conference as soon as next school year. Consensus from the Shenandoah School Board at its late Monday afternoon meeting was for the district to begin the transition from the Hawkeye 10 Conference to the Western Iowa Conference as early as next school year. Shenandoah School Superintendent Dr. Kerry Nelson says the Hawkeye 10 Board of Control recently voted unanimously to allow Shenandoah, Red Oak, and Lewis Central to leave the conference at the conclusion of the 2025-26 activity season.
They would prefer that all of the schools leaving the Hawkeye 10 leave at one time. They would strongly prefer that that occur next school year for 26-27. Originally, we were bound to a two-year commitment, and we told them, you know, we'll follow whatever the handbook says or whatever you enforce. But at this time, it's their preference and their voted agreement. You know, they'll release us for the 26-27 school year.
At the same time, Nelson says WIC officials recently indicated all schools entering or leaving their conference transition in the 2026-27 school year. Nelson says that's earlier than the three-year transition period originally anticipated.
That's different than what we had talked about early on. In talking to our own staff, most certainly our administrative team believes that this is the best to transition for next year. So I think it's the right decision and the right move, but I just wanted to be very open about the fact that it's different than the original timeline that was posed.
Nelson says the earlier transition will impact a number of athletic conferences and teams in KMA land. Under a bill approved in last year's Iowa legislative session, any conference switch must be approved by a state conference realignment committee comprised of 9 school superintendents and 9 activities directors from across Iowa. That committee is not expected to meet until this coming winter. Still to come, another edition of As the Turbine Turns. Stay tuned. Progress continues on a wind turbine project in the southwest corner of Page County. John Huff, Project Outreach Manager for Mid-American Energy, updated the Page County Board of Supervisors late Tuesday afternoon on the Shenandoah Hills Wind Project. Huff says as of Tuesday, crews erected 11 of the 21 turbines slated for Page County's side of the project, which includes 54 total turbines between Page and Fremont counties south of Shenandoah. With all the turbine components delivered, Huff says much of the heavy vehicle traffic should start to dwindle as more turbines are completed.
And after the second week of November, the crane activity should really be wrapped up or at least very, very close at that point. There will be some site restoration that goes on in 2026 still, but the wind farm is going to be operational by the end of 2025. And that's getting closer and closer. Unfortunately, we have had some really good productivity lately, so things are in a good place from what I understand.
As the turbines go up, Huff notes that MidAmerican will also start to transfer maintenance responsibility for the haul routes back to the county.
As these turbines get erected, per the road use agreement of Page County, it's at that point where we would be able to start turning over those roads to with the guidance of JD, of course. Point I'm trying to make is there may still be some light, like passenger vehicle traffic and things like that, after the roads get turned over and our maintenance obligation ends. But the heavy equipment stuff is, like I said, it should be about done second week of November. And
Supervisor Todd Mayer says he received a couple of calls regarding 280th Street still being used by heavy vehicles after last week's meeting, where MidAmerican officials noted crews were likely done using the road, along with trucks using a small portion of F Avenue that was not part of the road use agreement. Mayer suggested going around the project area with Huff when he's on site to see any potential trouble areas in person and work on solutions.
There's people, obviously, that are upset about the project. There's people that are for the project. And, you know, and now with harvest going on, there's a lot more traffic than maybe that would be usual. So that's adding to it, too. People are trying to navigate those county roads. So anything that we can do to be transparent and show that at least we're listening and trying to do the right thing, that I think that goes a long ways to being a good partner in this whole project.
Huff adds he's willing to tour the project with Maher to review any potential trouble spots. Construction of a Shenandoah project continues despite a government-induced snag in the funding portion. By unanimous vote, Tuesday evening, the Shenandoah City Council approved a pay application totaling more than $3 million to all-purpose construction for the wastewater treatment plant's expansion and renovation project. The payment is subject to approval by the USDA. Though the funding for the project is still there, City Administrator A.J. Lyman says the USDA's approval is delayed because of the continuing federal government shutdown.
We have reached out to the USDA attempting to find somebody with still working and with the authority to sign our pay application. Per the terms of the loan agreement, we cannot disperse any funds without USDA authorization. We have yet to locate that person with the USDA. We have also reached out to our elected officials at the federal level in an attempt to help us locate that person.
Despite the shutdown, Lyman recommended the council approve the pay application.
Without that, we cannot issue any specific payment. However, council can go ahead and approve that, so when the shutdown is over, we can not have to hold a special meeting to do that or delay that payment.
In September of last year, the council approved a proposal to purchase $33 million in sewer revenue capital loan notes, anticipation project notes, for a comprehensive facelift for the city's 61-year-old facility. The move provided interim financing to cover long-term funding from the USDA. Glenwood officials are putting an updated ordinance regarding skateboards, roller skates, and scooters on hold for a few weeks. At its regular meeting Tuesday evening, the Glenwood City Council tabled action on the first reading of an ordinance amendment, adding electric scooters to the list of forms of transportation prohibited on the streets listed in the ordinance. Those forms also include skateboards, roller skates, and scooters. The ordinance amendment would have also barred such vehicles from being used in the streets of the former Glenwood Resource Center campus, among other streets. A handful of residents spoke out during the meeting, primarily raising concerns the ordinance might also limit the recreational vehicles from public parks. Glenwood Mayor Angie Winquist says the code's wording likely led to some confusion related to public parks.
It says skateboards, roller skates, and scooters are prohibited from public parks and from streets and sidewalks within the corporate limits, listed as follows. We don't list the parks, so I don't think it was intended. So we probably to make it open because we aren't banned in the parks. I don't think I think that's the way it got worded. I think that was an oversight from the original one. So we need to probably take that out.
The ordinance also requires anyone using such vehicles on a sidewalk where it's not prohibited to yield to any pedestrians. While agreeing they shouldn't bar the vehicles from being used in public parks, Glenwood Police Chief Eric Johansson says it could be beneficial to limit them to sidewalks in the parks.
We might want to consult the park board, but we might want to limit it to the sidewalks at the park. And the only reason I say that is because I know we've had issues with damage to the amphitheater from skateboards.
Sandy Winton is among those airing concerns over the ordinance during the public comment period, calling for the easing of some of the restrictions. Winton says public parks in particular should be a welcoming space for activity.
Currently, scooters, skateboards, or roller skates are not allowed at our lake park. Sharp Street itself is prohibited for people with those modes of transportation. So even if you could use the park, you wouldn't be able to get there unless by car or if you carried those items. Easing restrictions on local streets and the park would allow kids to travel responsibly to places they love, without forcing parents to drive them or discouraging movement altogether.
Council is expected to consider the first reading of the ordinance amendment with updated language at its next meeting, October 28th. Sydney officials are exploring options to get updated digital zoning and utility maps for the city. On Monday night, the Sydney City Council heard a presentation from Dustin Henglinger of SAM Mapping out of Maryville, discussing the possibility of providing the city with necessary services to shift towards a GIS system for its utility and zoning maps. Sydney Mayor Justin Shirley tells KMA News much of the presentation surrounded the benefits and additional details the digital maps would provide.
How those could benefit our Public Works Department by locating valves, hydrants, manholes, and then mapping line diameter, pipe size, and depth. Basically an all-encompassing system that our Public Works crew can use to have better, I guess, schematics of what our our water and sewer systems are.
Shirley notes they currently utilize paper maps that are posted at City Hall. If the council went with the complete package presented by SAM Mapping, Shirley says the estimated initial cost is $51,000 plus an annual $1,200 expense for web housing fees. The new maps would be beneficial, Shirley says the council tabled action Monday night. That wraps up this week in KMA Land. Be listening each week at this time for This Week in KMA Land. And for more information all the time, log on to KMALand.com, where you can also hear this program in its entirety. For the entire KMA News team, this is Mike Peterson. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. This Week in KMA Land, a presentation of KMA News.